Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews coming up here in just a couple of seconds. We got some bad behaviors that are more common than you realize that we're going to chat about. It's the 80th anniversary of Wizard of Oz, so we're going to talk about the most important blockbusters of all time and fast food fails. So that's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk or text. You can also follow us at Twitter at Nick D Show and also on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. Monday morning movie reviews every week. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me to review all the new movies, and then we'll do the box office report as well with Eric. Let's get the guys on here. And Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome.
Hello.
All right. So we're here. And, well, Steve, I saw that you went to go see Society last night. So,
oh, I did indeed. And I've never seen it before. So
oh,
it was
really?
First time, yeah.
Wow. What was the crowd like?
It was about half full.
Yeah.
Which for a Sunday night on a school night is pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And these were a lot of people who had never seen this movie before, and the ones that had were just as excited as the ones that hadn't.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I had Brian, using on the show last week.
Yeah. He was there.
Great guest, man.
He was terrific. Yeah. He was a lot of fun to talk to. Yeah.
Yeah. He's very, very, and that movie's something.
And about halfway through, I realized that it wasn't really going to kick into high gear until the very end.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's when I just sort of settled in. I'm like, I don't know what I'm about to see, but, and it was beyond my wildest
dreams.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. 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 It's something. It's something.
It was next level.
I can't believe you've never seen it.
It feels like I'd heard of it, but I guess I would have been living here when it came out, but I honestly don't remember it being in theaters. So, and somehow I also missed it on home video. So,
okay, well,
yeah, and that was like my specialty growing up. So I don't know how I missed it. It's just like a weird little singular hole in my horror knowledge. Yeah.
Now, Eric, you've seen it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't remember it exactly being in theaters either, but it came out or it was out at some point while I was had my first job at a video store. So that's when I saw it.
I saw it on VHS.
Yeah, me too.
I think a lot of people did at that time. So,
all
right, well, there you go. That was fun.
It was great. capped off a great, 90th anniversary weekend.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Had 90th anniversary at the music mm-hmm. box. Nice way to tap it off right there.
Well, it's not done. We're not done,
no,
but it was
no.
a nice way to cap off the weekend. Yeah,
right.
For sure.
Right. There's more stuff coming up, right, for the 90th?
There's still a few more. Yeah, we've got a couple double features coming up. One of two Music Box Films movies, including the Oscar-winning Ida. And then on Wednesday, we're playing an audience choice double feature. We put up about 10 choices from double bills we had played back in the 80s when we were strictly a double bill theater.
Right, right.
And they overwhelmingly decided on playing The Terminator and RoboCop back-to-back in 35mm. It's selling very well. So if you are thinking about going, get your ticket. And then, of course, Thursday's the big, we're playing a 70mm print that we've never played before. A film in 70 we never played before, which is Back to the Future Part 2. So,
yeah. Wow. Back to
and
the
I'm
Future
guessing
Part
that will
two.
Sell out too. So.
Yeah, Back to the Future Part 2 in 70.
I know. I suspect all three of them are. I think we played the first one once. But I know we've never played this one before, so
yeah.
and it was kind of a last minute find, and I think we had another 70 in mind of one we had played before, but we're always looking for prints that we haven't played before, so
right.
So it's very exciting,
very very cool. And you guys are also showing a 35mm print of Matrix.
Eventually, yes. Yeah, that's coming up. I want to say I think they just put it on sale too, or about to. I want to say that's November. But yes, that is true. We are
okay.
doing that.
Because I'm going to see it this weekend.
Right, the Fathom Events thing.
Yeah,
it's
AMC. It's,
okay,
it's they're re-releasing it for the 20th anniversary, and,
uh-huh.
it's in the Dolby Theater.
Right, right, right. So, I saw that.
So yeah, I will be going to see the Matrix. So, all right, cool. Well, Steve, tell us about the Peanut Butter Falcon.
All right. This one could have gone really wrong, but fortunately, the feature writing and directing debut from a couple of guys named Michael Schwartz and Tyler Nilsson really got me hard and sort of right in the heart. It's not your typical tearjerker. I don't mean to imply that, but the Peanut Butter Falcon reminds me of sort of a road movie that might have been made in like the late 60s or pretty much any time during the 70s. It concerns a young man named Zach, who's played by a gentleman, a newcomer named Zach Gottsagen. He's a young guy with Down syndrome who escapes from a group home that he's living in, which is really just an old folks home that somebody put him in because they didn't know where else to put him, and this is in North Carolina. And he escapes to pursue the goal of meeting his wrestling hero named the Saltwater Redneck, who is played by Thomas Hayden Church, and who he basically only sees through a series of really old, like probably at least 20 years old videotapes that he has in his room. And on these tapes, the Saltwater Redneck is touting a wrestling school that he has in Florida, and so the kid wants to leave the home and go and learn to wrestle from his hero. And so early in this journey to Florida, he befriends a local guy, a fisherman, who's really more of a guy that steals the traps, the crab traps from other fishermen, but the guy has a short temper. His name is Tyler, and he's played by Shia LaBeouf. He has a tendency, like I said, to steal from other fishermen, and after basically getting his ass kicked for doing that, Tyler retaliates by burning thousands of dollars worth of fishing equipment that belong to another local crab fisherman played by John Hawks, who spends most of the film from that point forward hunting Tyler. Zach and Tyler form sort of an uneasy bond, but since Tyler refuses to treat Zach like someone with any limitations, Zach is sort of empowered during their journey, and he's able to learn and take care of himself at a pace that probably staying in the home wouldn't allow. The journey for these two that they take together is very important, but it's really the conversations they have and the lessons that they share with each other that make the film so moving, while refusing to let it get really sentimental or preachy or anything like that. Far from it. Unless you think someone from the home isn't looking for Zach, who has escaped, his primary caregiver is a woman named Eleanor, played by Dakota Johnson, different, who once again gives a really unexpectedly good performance as the film's sort of voice of reason here. And she's sort of hot on their trail, and when she finally does catch up with him, rather than drag Zach immediately back to the home, she allows the journey to continue, if only so Zach can learn that his longtime dream is more than likely going to end in disappointment, and she thinks that's a valuable lesson for him to learn. As much as I'd love to avoid making sort of Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn comparisons to this story, these guys may build a raft. It's sort of unavoidable at one point. But the Peanut Butter Falcon, the title itself actually comes from Zach giving himself a wrestling name, which is sort of a combination of his favorite food and his favorite animal. And it's a very different kind of coming-of-age story, not just for Zach, who certainly is different by the time the film is over, but also Tyler kind of learns a little bit about letting go of his many failures that are holding him back, and also learns how to be a little less of a tool around women, which is probably the best thing that happens to him on this trip. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that they do eventually make it to the home of this wrestler, this aging wrestler who the years have not necessarily been kind to him, which doesn't mean that the movie doesn't find ways to, very small and poignant ways, to make itself a little bit magical and really sweet. And that has a great deal to do with Gottsagen's wonderfully charming performance. He's got more charisma and a gift for timing than just about any other much better known actor that I've seen this year, and I hope he becomes one of the year's breakthrough performers. Eric, be sure to add him to the list if you haven't already. But the way he and LaBeouf work together is like their lives have been sort of leading up to this moment. So I will add one thing that I think at this point, Shia LaBeouf's name needs to stop being a punchline for every joke about some off-kilter celebrity and give the dude the absolute credit he deserves for being such a great actor, one of the best ones working right now. Nick, just wait until you see him in a movie called Honey Boy that we saw at Sundance, because that's going to blow you away.
And I
think that's in November. But anyway, the Peanut Butter Falcon is sweet, like I said, without piling on the saccharin. It's a tremendous story about pain and acceptance and how both can lead to growth, and it's certainly one of the more surprising and under-the-radar releases of the year, and I hope people seek it out and take a chance. And they don't have to seek it out, because I can tell you it's playing at the Landmark.
Yeah.
And maybe other places, too, but there for sure.
All right. I also noticed that Jake the Snake Roberts and Mick Foley are both in it.
Yes. I didn't want to say too much about, I don't want to ruin every surprise, but if you want to, that's fine.
No, I was just looking at the, I didn't know a big surprise, but I'm looking at the IMDb page.
They're in there at the end, in Florida with the, at the wrestling school. I'll put it that way. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right.
It's a really nice, especially if you're a wrestling fan, like an old school wrestling fan, I think you're going to recognize not just the people, but like the hero worship that was going on at the time. So. Yeah. Yeah, it's really nice.
Okay, it's playing in a bunch of theaters, by the way.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, it's playing in a bunch of theaters. So that's the Peanut Butter Falcon.
And if you get a chance to find out, like read, go online and read a story about how this film got made, because it's one of the coolest stories about how these guys that were basically broke and homeless made a movie. Mm. And like certain celebrities kind of helped them when they didn't really have to and they didn't have connections, and they got this movie made. And a lot of people are saying it's one of the best movies of the year. So,
all right.
So yeah, check it out.
Okay, cool. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, there you go. Eric and Steve, we're going to hang on, and then we got more movies to talk about. And we'll do the box office as well right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
All right, welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about some of the most important blockbusters of all time on this, the 80th anniversary of Wizard of Oz, which is considered one. Some bad behavior we're going to talk about, and some fast food fails, and so much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Also, Monday morning, that means it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews with Steve Procopi and Eric Childress. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, tell us about After the Wedding.
Okay, well, this is actually a remake of the 2006 film by Suzanne Bier, and this one has a bit of a role reversal in it, in that this one stars Michelle Williams as a young woman named, or a woman named Isabel. I always think of Michelle Williams as a young woman. I can't believe she's almost 40 years old, but anyway. But she's a woman who is part of a founder of an orphanage in Calcutta. An orphanage that is drastically sort of dwindling in funds and supplies. And in sort of desperation, she ends up traveling to New York to meet with a very sort of rich industrialist, a benefactor, played by Julianne Moore. Her character, while is open to listening to her story and potentially donating to the cause, she has things on her mind right now because her daughter is actually getting married this weekend, and she can't seem to commit to anything except that. So she invites Isabel to come to the wedding, stay in town over the weekend, and then they'll hash everything out on Monday. Much to the chagrin of Isabel, who everything is just kind of spiraling out of control, at least the way she sort of presents it. And so every day seems like, something bad could happen at the orphanage. But she ends up doing it, and while she is at the wedding, she realizes that her past is about to sort of come, smack her right in the face. Julianne Moore's husband is played by Billy Crudup. And turns out that Isabel and Crudup's character had a relationship back in the day. And it turns out that the daughter is actually her daughter. This is not exactly spoiler material. This is all kind of happens in the first 20, 25 minutes of the movie. And so the complications of all these things coming back to fruition, reuniting with the daughter, you know, coming to terms with the past that she actually abandoned this child, who's really at fault, you know, for all these things. And then the film just keeps kind of spiraling into further twists. And you know, other things that happen, you know, between these characters, ultimatums are met, more tragedy is on the horizon, and this film, like the orphanage scene, seems to be spiraling out of control. This kind of seems like the kind of the polar opposite to the movie that Steve just reviewed, in that the way he described it as a movie that, you know, even when you're hearing him talk about it, could have very easily gotten away from itself and developed into something really maudlin and melodramatic and, you know, possibly even exploitive. And that this one feels just so into the melodrama of it all, that it can't help but just being sort of just overly melodramatic at every possible turn. I mean, the music swells at certain points. Once these twists and turns in Isabel's life begin happening, it just seems like everything just keeps piling onto her, one thing after another. And, you know, Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore are two of my absolute favorite actresses on the planet, and they seem just kind of stuck in this material, and they have to sort of, I don't know, go really deep within themselves to try to match the way that Bart Freundlich is directing this thing. Michelle Williams' character from the very beginning just seems like she's about to just burst out into either tears or outrage at any possible moment, and watching Michelle Williams struggle trying to keep all of that interior and yet keeping it all on her face at the same time was just really just kind of frustrating and uncomfortable to watch. And then Julianne Moore's character, at some point I thought this movie was actually going to cross over into the Still Alice universe. The things that develop with her character are just, again, everything just sort of seems to sort of spiral out of control, and none of it feels real. Nothing in this movie feels like something that would actually happen in real life. Even the sort of the ultimatum that Isabel's character is then forced to confront in the second half of this movie doesn't feel like a real thing. It feels contrived. It feels invented for someone to, and a movie that, and the screenplay doesn't even wrestle with the sort of the moral choice of the thing. It's just kind of there, and it's kind of like, well, you know, there are pluses and minuses to both of these choices, and it's like, oh, I'm going to do this, and then the other, you know, other shoe drops, and it's like, oh, okay, whatever. That's what this movie kind of feels like, and so, like, none of it feels real. The performances are just, again, it doesn't help Bart Freundlich, who is not exactly developed a great filmography, I would say. He's just lucky he has Julianne Moore as a partner, and so whatever weight that they might give this movie is nevertheless just kind of downtrodden because of the way he directs this movie. This one just did not work for me at all.
Okay, what do you think, Steve?
Yeah, he's right. It's kind of a mess, and but he's also right that this could have gone so right, and in fact it has gone right, because it's like he said, it's a remake, and the original film is really good. And it stars, and he mentioned the role reversal, but it's the role reversal is a gender reversal. It's actually this character that Michelle Williams plays was played by Mads Mikkelsen in the original, and he's right. It doesn't feel like this is in the real world. These are characters who are just going through the motions of a overly complicated screenplay, and it never really gets beyond that. I have no issue with gender reversal. It's a great idea in a remake, just to make it interesting at least, but it almost doesn't make sense. Like, it makes more sense that a man could feasibly, like a woman, he could get a woman pregnant and never find out about it. That makes a certain amount of sense. This is literally like this woman doesn't know she has a daughter out there. And I'm like, how is that possible? How, I mean, she knows she has one, but how does she, I mean, it just kind of blew my mind. Like, that doesn't even completely make sense. I mean, they had agreed to put her up for adoption, and then he sort of secretly reneged on that and didn't tell her. So that's how it happens. But it still seems far-fetched that she might not have known about that at some point. So, but yeah, the real reason it didn't work for me was that how much of a manipulative liar that Julianne Moore's character is, and her need to control every situation in her life is frustrating to watch. It's unnecessary. Just like pulling people together and having them talk about the situation makes way more sense, but to go through it this way makes her plight, and there is a plight in her life, the reason she's doing all of this and has set all these wheels in motion, it makes her way less sympathetic by the way she actually goes about it. She says she's doing it for the greater good, but nobody seems happy about anything she's doing, which is, you know, of course, never makes her reconsider her motives or actions, but whatever. Without earning it, the film kind of packs in all these life-changing secrets and trying again and again to get us to care about the trials of these sort of privileged and insufferable people. I will say I liked the actress that plays the daughter, Abby Quinn, who did a pretty great job in a movie called Landline. I think she played Jenny Slate's sister in that. Was that right?
Yeah.
I thought she was really good in that, and I think she's pretty good here, too, as this girl that when she finds out the truth, she gets very mad at her parents and turns to Michelle Williams for discomfort of some sort. You know, these are all really good actors. Billy Crudup is here playing another, like, terrible human being like he did in Bernadette. They can't make this material work out of the wreckage it ends up becoming. So, unfortunately, when a translation like this happens sometimes, and I'm not against remakes at all, but it just sort of loses all the subtlety and power of the original, and it seems like a lose-lose for everybody involved, including me. So, and go watch the original. It's on iTunes.
Okay, there you go. So that's after the wedding, which is out now. Okay, guys, hang on.
Yes.
All right. Eric and Steve are here, and we're reviewing the new movies. Got a few more here, or a couple more to review, and then we'll get to the box office with Eric right after we break here on 720 WGN. Yeah, welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we got much more coming up here. 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Steve and Eric are here. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Let's get these guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Steve, why don't you tell us about Angel Has Fallen.
Why, because you hate me? What is it? Here's my dirty little secret is that I don't hate any of these movies in their entirety. I found something very sort of fun about each of them. Basically, these are the movies that tell us that every 3 years something falls. First, we had Olympus Has Fallen in 2013, and then London Has Fallen in 2016, and here we are again. Secret Service agent Mike Banning, who's played by Gerard Butler, finds himself, in this case, framed for the assassination attempt on the president's life, the president played by Morgan Freeman, an attempt that results in every Secret Service agent protecting the president dead except him, and then he becomes pursued by his own agency in the FBI, and Banning basically races and spends the whole movie trying to clear his name and uncover where the real terrorist threat is coming from. But the problem with that setup is that the rules of casting state that if you put Danny Houston in a movie, you can't pretend like we don't know where the bad guy is hidden in this movie. He, even though he's presented to us as an old friend of Mike's, and a guy who's sort of trying to get his little band of mercenaries some work, government contracts to help sort of supplement military types in different wars around the world, you know, who else could it be? Let's just face it. And you can't. What's even funnier is that that he's actually being controlled by somebody else who, for most of the film, we only hear on the phone with the distortion on it, which immediately means that. But he always seems to know. I think he knows who this person is. So why is he distorting his voice? One, that's because of us. Which, and if they're trying to keep his voice from us, that means it's another character in the movie that we. And again, not hard to figure out who it is, because who immediately benefits from a president being killed? Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that. But anyway, there's not a lot of surprises in this film. Let's put it that way. The president is before all hell breaks loose, the president's planning on banning the Secret Service director, succeeding the retiring Lance Reddick as Director Gentry. But Mike has suffered enough concussions and spinal injuries and other bumps and bruises that he may be ready to call it quits rather than take a desk job. He wants to spend more time with his wife and kid. Makes sense. No one seems to care that banning killing the president on behalf of the Russians, as we find out, makes absolutely no sense, including a seemingly very intelligent FBI agent played by Jada Pinkett Smith. The film basically becomes The Fugitive. It's a guy trying to prove himself, and I know this because I just saw The Fugitive a couple days ago, so it kind of becomes that scenario where the guy's just able to infiltrate pretty much anywhere he wants to because he knows the Secret Service protocol, and they don't bother to change it because of just who he is. There comes a point where we're even questioning Danny Houston's motivations, especially when everyone knows he's behind all this, which I guess, I don't know. The action is pretty solid most of the time. Butler is sort of appropriately gruff. There's a very funny supporting role by Nick Nolte as his downright hilarious, off-the-grid survivalist father that just made me giggle every time he came on screen because he looks ridiculous. The film, again, like never feels authentic, really, but it still has the capacity to be fun at times. Angel Has Fallen sort of has its moments, but ultimately it's way too predictable and standard issue as an action film. Despite a few sort of moments of potential, it's kind of a dud, and I hope we're done with these movies.
Okay. All right. Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I can't even be pseudo-apologetic for this entire trilogy. Olympus Has Fallen was one of the more uglier experiences I've had in a theater in some time. I remember actually, not since Bad Boys 2, did I actually get almost physically ill during the big attack sequence on the White House in that movie. But at least that movie had some technical merit to it. Antoine Fuqua directed it, and it is ugly and unpleasant and, you know, just stupid as it was. At least, you know, it kind of, you know, had, you know, moments that of technical prowess.
I always get that one confused with the one that Channing Tatum was in.
Well, that one's much better because that one has a sense of ridiculousness about it. And again, yeah. I don't like to make any kind of apologies for Roland Emmerich, but that movie is at least goofy. And London Has Fallen is an incompetent mess. And I mean, but the, you know, best thing I can say about this movie is that it's actually the funniest of the three movies for some of the reasons that Steve just mentioned. Danny Houston is set up as your best friend in the beginning of the movie, and then, you know, they're set up like if there's a mystery villain, you know who it's going to be. And then when they set up a second mystery villain during the reveal of the first mystery villain, there's only one other character in the movie who it can be. And then when that's revealed, you know, a half hour later, it's absolutely zero surprise. You know, Steve's not the only one that's compared this movie to The Fugitive. The producer of the movie has compared this movie to The Fugitive. And I think that that's a real setback for The Fugitive, even being, you know, any kind of association with this movie. This movie is actually more... Just plot-wise, it's like they took the plot to the season 5 of 24 and combined it with that really awful Michael Douglas, Kiefer Sutherland movie Ghost Sentinel from 2006.
Oh, God.
You remember that movie? That was another movie. Michael Douglas was a Secret Service agent, not convicted, but believed to be part of a conspiracy to assassinate the president, and he has to go on the run. That's this movie, except this movie has lesser actors in it, or at least lesser actors giving lesser parts to play. It's not fun, really, in any stretch of the imagination. That my favorite bit in the entire movie, there's a moment where Tim Blake Nelson, who is now taken over as president, or at least is about to, and talking about the potential conspiracy to assassinate Morgan Freeman, and he actually talks about how they have to respond to the Russians to do this, and they're just like, and he's like, and if we don't respond to them, they're going to think we're weak, and then he literally looks at the camera and goes, just like when they meddled in our election. I couldn't believe it. I wanted to rewind the movie on screen just to see that moment again, because he looks right at the camera and says that, like, wah, wah. The action in this movie is kind of incompetent. There's a chase scene that I think is shot from the POV of trees. The stuff, Nick Nolte is in full Oscar clip mode, which, again, is kind of funny. Given that nobody else in this movie is clearly going for an Oscar, but Nolte is. And then they just kind of, you know, he disappears, you know, for the climax of this movie, and that's really unfortunate too, which is just a big run through a giant hospital. There's no creativity in this movie. There's barely any creativity in this entire series. I literally have nothing against Gerard Butler other than the fact that he just picks terrible screenplays. He seems like a decent guy. I don't think he's a terrible actor, but he makes really bad movies. And this I can't believe this is a trilogy now. But here it is, and it's pretty awful.
Okay. He's made another movie with this director already. So, get ready for that.
Wow. Former stuntman turned filmmaker.
Yeah. Another one of them. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, there it is. That's Angel Has Fallen. I did not see it. So
what?
I did not see it. You guys hang on, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right. Eric and Steve are here, and we've got one more movie to review, and then we'll jump in on the box office numbers for the weekend as well. All right. We'll do that right after this on 720 WGN. How's everybody doing this morning? Monday morning. Welcome back, everybody. And it's Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And we got much more stuff happening on the show this morning. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And let's get back to the movie reviews. Monday morning movie reviews happen every Monday morning with Eric and Steve. And let's get these guys back in. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Eric, why don't you tell us about Ready or Not?
Okay. Well, this is a horror film that stars Samara Weaving as a woman as we meet her on her wedding day. She's about to marry into a very rich family, and turns out a very eccentric family. And after the wedding, another film that could have been called After the Wedding, they have a very interesting tradition. The family, turns out, has made much of their fortune through games. A lot of board games and things sort of line their house. They have a tradition where if anyone who marries into the family plays a game with the entire family in their giant country estate at midnight. So the patriarch of the family, Henry Cherney, and the matriarch is played by Annie McDowell, tells the story about how they sort of came into their fortune. Their great-grandfather made a pact with a benefactor who suggested that if a particular game is played, then the family would then have to offer that person as a sacrifice before dawn, otherwise they will all die. Well, unfortunately for Weaving's character, she picks the bad card, as they call it. The game she gets chosen to play is hide-and-seek. So we get a most dangerous game type situation where she, at first, believes she's just playing hide-and-seek, but soon realizes that the entire family is out to get her and to kill her before dawn. Her fiancé obviously does not want this to happen, so he makes the best effort he can to try to save her throughout the night. The fiancé's brother, played by Adam Brody, is sort of a little bit in between. He loves his brother, he likes the bride, but the family fortune, and his potential death, sort of gives him, a little bit of pause and skepticism about whether or not he should actually take part in this whole thing. That's the basic setup of this movie. And the setup of this movie, and I would say the first half of this movie, I liked a lot. I was so digging this movie. I think this movie kind of cut the right vibe. It's very funny throughout most of the film. So even when the film does get gruesome and, playing upon this idea of a lot of people potentially dying and this really horrible thing happening to this woman, it does maintain a really great sense of humor, particularly that, this family is not exactly a group of experienced hunters. This is not hard target we're dealing with. They're mostly just kind of winging it for the most part. Once Weaving's character realizes what's going on, has to basically become a hunter herself. And it was somewhere about midway through the movie where I kept waiting for this movie to sort of get to the real next level, that it was really just kind of take the opportunity to sort of supercharge this character, and it wasn't just going to be some climactic thing where she realizes she has to fight back. Very early on, there's already this sort of this iconic image of her grabbing this giant elephant gun with these gigantic bullets, and it seems like, okay, she's going to take charge of this thing, and the movie at first, kind of has some fun with exactly, how far her and her fiancé are going to go in, dispatching of this family, or, trying to survive the night. And I think that, that works for a while, but then it keeps kind of retracing its steps a little bit. It keeps kind of going over the same joke a couple of times, maybe it's my own sort of personal bloodlust, but I was really kind of hoping this movie was going to go charter into your next type territory, which is what this movie really feels like the real inspiration from, than the kind of the supernatural shenanigans that occur within it. I think that the movie would have leaned less on that, particularly during the things that occur later on. I think they would have had a real classic on his hand. A lot of people are kind of labeling it that already. I still like the movie. I particularly like Samara Weaving's performance in the movie. I think she's really fantastic in it. I like just about all the actors in this movie. The actress who plays the sister who's basically doing Lloyd Bridges from Airplane with the drugs throughout this movie, she's particularly hilarious. And everybody's really good. And they really kind of feel like really formed characters, whether you hate them or kind of like them or whatever. They really feel like really kind of lived in characters, and so you really kind of draw a genuine interest in all of them, and who's going to live, who's going to die. And I wish that the movie just never got to supercharge point for me. Yet I still like the movie. I'm recommending the movie. I just wish that the ending had a little bit more oomph, more than just kind of a ha-ha moment to it.
All right. What'd you think, Steve?
I can't believe you don't think that ending is supercharged. I mean, it seems
exactly what I expected
to me.
First
of all, he's right. Samara Weaving is amazing. She's like extraordinary in this film, and I actually really thought what Andie MacDowell was doing here was pretty great, because she's basically playing a classic Andie MacDowell character, except that she will kill you. That's like a totally different kind of thing, but not in a mean way, in a very polite, very southern way. She's fantastic here. The core of the film is there's like this running joke that sort of beautifully underscores the message of this upper class, lower class world here. And the estate has like this handful of maids and one very intense butler who kind of get knocked off periodically throughout the film, usually by accident or carelessness. And then the family sees this and they're a little miffed by it, but basically they're like, whatever. They're dismissed as sort of collateral damage. That's this film in a nutshell. That's sort of what they look at when they look at Grace, because even if they don't want to kill her, they don't really look at her as equal to them. She came out of foster families, and some of them think she's a gold digger. I don't think she is, but she clearly is very much in love with this man. You may not have assumed it, but like her husband is not in favor of this process, and sort of attempts to protect her to a certain degree. But you can't necessarily trust anybody in the family, because we don't exactly know what's going to happen if it doesn't pay off at the end, if they don't get to kill her. We're not exactly sure what happens at dawn, and that's kind of one of the fun little mysteries of the film. Like I said, not everyone in the family is as into killing her as everybody else. And what's kind of funny is that they're all, like Eric mentioned, they're all inherently bad at this game, because they're either not into the idea of killing, or they're so into it that it stops them from playing intelligently. And I can't wait for people to get a gander of a character named Aunt Helene, because she's kind of amazing in this film. She's like a genuine monster here. But there's some really tight and effective directing by this directing team named Radio Silence, who I have kind of dug for a while. The film just kind of zings along like electricity. The killings are not clean and bloodless. We're done with PG-13 rated horror movies for a little while. This is a hard R. There's a lot of blood and a lot of pretty graphic gore. Although, like I said, the mood is light, and the mood is light, but we never are allowed to forget that the stakes are human life here. The production design and the costumes are kind of exquisite, and very deliberately sort of frame this Grace character to make her look and feel small and undeserving every time she steps into a new room. And when she does come face to face with someone who wants to kill her, she doesn't beg for her life, but she does sort of plead for them to stop with this stupid tradition. It's very big on tradition here, and that's a big thing in these rich families, and she just wants them to stop. But she's also a fighter. She's a survivor. She has been her whole life, and we know that early on, and Weaving is so good at playing that. The film could have very simply been a story of a young woman trying to survive in this world full of powerful people, especially men, who will never view her as an equal, but the full-bore attack on the rich is the more subversive and satisfying part of this movie. And if you can handle like substantial quantities of blood, This is a really easy film to love. So I get a wholehearted recommendation.
Okay. All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of it. Eric and Steve, hang on. They're hanging on, and we'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Ready or Not. And then we got the box office results here, too. All coming up right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call and tell a joke. We're going to talk about some of the most important blockbusters of all time, right around the 80th anniversary of Wizard of Oz. We got some bad behavior that we're going to talk about and some fast food fails. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Let's bring Eric and Steve back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Ready or Not. I thought it was great. I had a blast watching this movie. And is she related to Hugo Weaving?
Niece.
Her uncle is Hugo Weaving?
Yep.
Okay. All right. I was just because you don't see the name Weaving a lot. So, I mean, it was the first person.
I think his son is also a up and coming actor as well. So.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to be seeing him on the big screen next week.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Anderson. But no, this is fun stuff, man. And like you said, they don't shy away from the blood and guts in this thing, man. I just thought it was. I thought it was really funny. I thought it was very entertaining. She's fantastic in this movie, and the supporting players are great. It's beautifully shot. It's well directed. You get the bang for your buck in this movie, man. And if this is the kind of movie that you're looking for. This pays off big time. I was very entertained by it throughout the entire movie. I thought it was really, really funny and nice and bloody, and it was exactly the movie that I wanted it to be. When I first saw the trailer for it, I was just very entertained by the trailer. I saw the Red Band trailer. The first time, which actually kind of ruins a few things. If you've seen the Red Band trailer, they show a little too much for my liking. So there were certain moments in the movie I was like, oh, I saw that in the trailer. I don't need to see that. You know, I didn't need to see that in the trailer. But anyway, I thought it was vastly entertaining. The audience I saw it with had a great time. We were just, you know, a very entertaining movie. And again, I can't say enough about this Samara Weaving. She is fantastic. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. And didn't make any money at the box office, though.
Not a lot. No, yeah. Not really.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, I hope more people see it. Very entertaining movie. So I'm saying a big-time yes for Ready or Not. All right. What do we got next week?
Not much.
Oh, I'm not here. I'm not here.
Right.
I'm off. So,
Marathon finally opens here. What's that, Ray?
Which one opens?
Britney Runs a Marathon finally opens here.
Oh,
that's
good.
True.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that looks really good.
I just saw it. Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, it looks really, really good.
And if I could also put in a plug for something we may not get to in a couple weeks,
yeah.
There's a documentary opening next week called Love Antosha about Anton Yelchin. That is really, I was bawling most of the time watching it.
Oh.
It is really, really good. I know it's opening at the Landmark. It might be other places too, but okay. It is. I can just say it's tremendous.
Okay, great. All right. Well, there we go. You guys have a lovely Labor Day.
Thank you. You too.
Steve, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
There you go. Steve Procopi. All right, Eric, let's jump into the box office.
Yes.
All right, let's see. The Angel Has Fallen.
Yeah.
21.2 million.
I don't get it. I don't get it. The first movie did pretty well. The second movie came down in gross, but still grossed like $62 million. I thought this one was going to be headed into like the 30s total. And this movie came up with an opening that was very comparable to The London Has Fallen. I don't get it. I don't know what people see in these movies.
Yeah, I don't get it either. But yeah, $21 million. And then number two is Good Boys with $11.7 million, $42 million total. That's pretty solid, right?
Yeah. I mean, a 45% drop. It's probably going to drop. Have a very small drop. Most films are going to have a very small drop next week because there's not a lot of wide openings.
Right.
But it's on pace to do around $75 million right now. So that's very solid.
Number three, Overcomer.
Faith-based film.
$8.2 million.
Yeah. This guy, Alex Kendrick, I think is the director's name. He's done a bunch of these, like Facing the Giants, did a movie called War Room, I think like 4 or 5 years ago, that did very well right around this time of year. This one didn't open quite as well, but I don't know. He must have an audience because, yeah. $8.2 million on a weekend when very little opened.
Yeah.
Not terrible. It's actually not great considering it's the widest launch any of his movies has ever had. But it probably didn't cost, a dime and a half. So.
Yeah. All right. Number four, The Lion King, $8.1 million up to $510 million just in America.
Yeah, it's about to cross $1 billion just internationally.
Man.
It's $1.5 billion total right now. It's the ninth highest grossing film of all time. Probably headed at least one more notch up that chart. This thing's a monster.
Man, oh man. That's incredible. Number five, Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw. $8.1 million, $147 million total. That's underperforming, correct?
Underperforming only in the States. I mean, this is sort of like taking like sort of the Transformers route, that the grosses start to come down here because people start to, I don't know, get tired of these movies finally after nine movies. But internationally, it just opened in China this weekend. And so the global total is almost $600 million now.
Wow.
Yeah, so just China alone boosted the profits on this thing. It's not quite in profits yet because this movie cost $200 million to make.
Yeah.
But it's headed there, and it's going to get there. The profit might not end up being gigantic on this, but it is going to turn a profit.
Okay. Number six, Ready or Not, $7.5 million, $10 million, $10.5 million. Since because it opened on Wednesday,
right? Yeah, it's a $6 million production. The advertising stuff is going to boost that cost a bit. So this movie's going to end up somewhere around high 20s, maybe get to $30 million. So it's not going to be like a great loss for this movie. But if word of mouth can pick up a little bit, it might be able to turn a small profit still.
Yeah, I hope people go and see it because it's just so entertaining.
I do too.
Number seven, The Angry Birds movie 2. How's that compared to the first one?
It's about, right now, I mean, we're talking total of what the first movie did. So far it's grossed $278 million less than the previous film.
Wow.
Did, yeah. This is like Secret Life of Pets 2. Territory. Remember how much that movie dropped compared to the first movie?
Yeah, yeah.
And if studios would listen to me, I would tell them, there's never get involved in the land war in Asia, and there's don't open an animated film in August.
Right, right. Number eight, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, $6 million up to $50 million total. That's not bad.
Not at all. This movie's probably going to reach $65 million, and that should be more than enough to greenlight a sequel for it.
Good. All right. I'm ready for it. Number nine, Dora and the Lost City of Gold, $5.2 million, $43 million total.
Yeah, not the kind of numbers that they would have hoped for a very charming little movie too. It's probably going to get probably just over $50 million, maybe a little slightly higher. But I think they were probably hoping for something more in the $75-80 million range for this.
Okay, and then coming in at number 10 is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with $5 million. It's $123 million total.
Yeah, it's past the gross of Inglourious Bastards domestically. It's doing very well overseas now. It just opened overseas, I think, just last week. So the DiCaprio Pitt Tarantino draw overseas is doing very well. So it's over. It's about a $240 million worldwide right now. Needs about another 30 to break even, but this thing's probably going to go over $300 million worldwide.
Wow.
So, you know, yay originality.
Wow, there you go. All right. Well, what are we looking at next week? I mean,
I don't think you're going to see anything make a dent. I don't know if Brittany runs a marathon, how big of what kind of an expansion it's going to be getting. It's going to be opening here in Chicago, for starters. It opened in five theaters just this weekend, and it had a really great turnout. It made $175,000 in five theaters.
Yeah.
Which is like the eighth best per theater average of the year. So that gives a promise that there is an audience for this movie, and I hope that Amazon does right by it because it's pretty great.
Yeah.
So we'll see if they expand that enough, that might break into the top 10. Peanut Butter Falcon also did very well this week in like 900 and some theaters, made $2.8 million out of the top 10.
Right.
That's another movie that, you know, if Roadside expands that, could find an audience. But other than that, you know, next week, you know, we'll see, you know, Angel Has Fallen, even if it falls a lot, probably takes the number one slot again.
Yeah, well, everybody's just, I mean, it's at this point, everybody's just waiting for it.
That's right.
That's at this point. So,
it'll be Labor Day weekend. The grosses are not going to fall off that much from what we saw this weekend. So everything's going to, you know, get boosted a little bit.
Yeah.
But I don't think the rankings are going to see a big change in that.
Okay. All right, Eric. Thanks, man.
All right.
Have a great Labor Day. We're off next Monday. So, Eric, I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
There you go. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi, they will join me in a couple of weeks. We're off for Labor Day for next week. All right, we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN.